This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. At the beginning of 2011, Tunisia and Egypt were the vanguard of the uprisings that have transformed the Middle East, as the people of those nations drove out corrupt dictators through the power of mass protest. Now, they're at the forefront of the next step of that transformation, going to the polls in recent weeks, participating in elections that nearly all observers have called free and fair. But for the U.S. and some other folks, the outcomes of those elections may be a cause for concern. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said yesterday that transitions to democracy require fair and inclusive elections, but they also demand that those who are elected embrace what she called democratic norms, in which she included respect for universal human rights, including women's rights, free religious practice, the promotion of tolerance and good relations among communities of different faiths, and support for peaceful relations with neighbors. So, at this historic moment, what do you want to understand about the emerging democracies in Egypt and Tunisia? Is the U.S. right to raise the bar for these democracies before they've even had a chance to begin? Are you concerned that revolutions led by secular liberal forces could be co-opted by more conservative forces? And what will create the best conditions for the emergence of real democracy in the Middle East? To join the conversation, you can always call us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have friends or family in the region, if you have connections there, we would love to hear from you. If you're just someone who thinks about what the U.S. role in the world is and the negative elements, of course, we think about Egypt, we think of the connections that the United States certainly had to the repressive forces there, and that's often the case throughout the Middle East. What are the contradictions here in what you're hearing from the U.S. government? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-TALK, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And with us to dive into these questions for the hour is Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan and creator of the Informed Comment blog, which provides independent perspectives on Middle Eastern American politics. You can find it at juancole.com. And his latest book is Engaging the Muslim World. Welcome back to Your Call, Juan.
Thanks so much.
And also on the line with us is Mona El-Ghobashi. She's the assistant professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. She's an expert on Egypt's politics and economics. Thanks so much for joining us, Mona.
Thank you.
So let's first start with the parliamentary elections in Egypt last week, this first round of these elections. So these have been called a triumph for Muslim religious parties. Let's give some context. What were these elections? And from each of you, I'd like to know, what do you make of the results? Mona, why don't we start with you?
These elections were scheduled back in March with a constitutional referendum that voters went to approve. And the main task of the parliament that is currently being elected is first to write a constitution, to elect 100 members of a constituent assembly to write the constitution. This constitution, of course, is going to be critical because it's going to write the rules of the game of the new or the budding new Egyptian democracy. And as you pointed out, Islamist parties of two types so far have led in polls. These are the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a moderate political party. It's been in existence since 1928. And the more surprising factor was an Islamist group to their right, Salafi groups, that have captured something like 25% of the vote. And this has concerned many observers, both within and outside Egypt, for their generally harder-line stances on issues of women's rights and religion and politics.
Could you just define Salafi for us?
Salafi is a term that means predecessors. These are political groups that were previously harshly repressed by all of these regimes in the Middle East, and Mubarak's political regime repressed them quite savagely. And after the toppling of these autocrats, the Salafi groups have entered the political arena in full force, but they're a bit untested, again, because we don't know what exactly their interests are or their motivations. This is why this was a surprise that they did so well at the polls.
Yeah, I kind of think the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, that's you know, you turn on Fox News, you can hear about the Muslim Brotherhood, but we hadn't heard so much about al-Nur. Juan Cole, what would you add to what Mona's had to say about the context of these elections and what you make out of the results?
The performance of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was not a surprise. It was clear that it was organized, it knew how to run elections, it knew how to canvass neighborhoods. In some senses, the Mubarak government that preceded the current interim government had brought the Muslim Brotherhood in at some points as a kind of junior partner. So in the 2006 parliamentary elections, the Muslim Brotherhood got 88 seats out of some 450. So nobody else among the well-thought-of parties had that kind of experience. The rest of them had either been in the cold or are new organizations or kind of youth groups or networks. So the Brotherhood was foreordained, I think, to do well in these elections. And it got, you know, in the area of what had been predicted. I mean, people had said the upper limit would get 30-35%. It's probably done more like 40-45%, but this is not a huge surprise. The surprise is the Salafis, because they are a group that weren't as well known and hadn't been involved in politics and kind of had been quietists in the Mubarak period, hadn't come out in force. And now all of a sudden they've entered parliamentary politics, and very successfully so. A lot of us suspect that there's Gulf money behind them, and many of them probably were guest workers in the Gulf and have networks outside the country that's giving them support. And one thing I would caution is that I don't think it's clear that they got as much as 25% of the vote. They got 25% of the seats in the party-based part of the election, which elects two-thirds of the parliamentarians, which would be 16% of the vote. They haven't run well as independents, which is the other one-third.
So I
think their proportion of the total is less than might seem so far.
So you just, obviously this is just the first round of these elections, and Juan, on your Informed Comment blog, you do a good breakdown kind of talking about where you see, how you see this might play out in the rounds following. I mean, Mona talks about how important this body will be in terms of writing a constitution for Egypt. What are you kind of predicting based on these first round results?
Well, the election of the interim parliament is consequential for the writing of the constitution, but it's not decisive, because unless it's changed, and it could be changed, but at the moment the plan is for the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SCAF, to appoint 80% of the members of the Constituent Assembly that will write the Constitution. And SCAF has also issued guidelines for the writing of the Constitution and declared that it will take upon itself to veto articles that it thinks are injurious to the common weal. So it's a Constitution over which, as now, things now stand, the military would have a lot of influence and even veto power. Therefore, were the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis attempt to take Egypt in a Iran-style direction, I think there would be pushback from the Egyptian elite, and they have the instrument of the SCAF to make that impression.
Moni, I just want to hear from you. Kind of, no matter who wins these elections, is the military really still in control in Egypt?
Very much so. Just to fill in a little bit of what Juan was saying, the military started out by indicating that they would hand over power to civilians within a six-month time frame. This was back in March. But however, things developed very quickly and differently since then. The military has made its intention very clear that it wants to steer the transition, not just steer the transition, but to go back on its original intentions and to pretty much select the 80 members of the 100-member Constituent Assembly. This caused widespread protests in Egypt, and indeed the protests that occurred in November, where 44 protesters died as a result of security forces repression, initially started as a protest against the military's attempt to gain the transition, to write itself a role in the Constitution, and to inscribe for itself basically a Turkish-style role in the emerging Egyptian democracy, to basically have a guided democracy where if the military is unhappy with any of the political outcomes of the elected parliament, it can simply annul election results and tell the government to go back and form a different kind of set of policy directives.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're talking about the future of democracy in the Middle East. Specifically, so far we've been talking about Egypt. We'll also be talking about Tunisia and other countries in the area, and asking what the response from the U.S. should be, what the best ways are to nurture real democracy there, whether that means U.S. having hands off or being involved more directly. Talking with Juan Cole. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan, creator of the Informed Comment blog, and you were just hearing from Mona Al-Ghobashi. She's a political science at Barnard College, an expert on economics and politics in Egypt. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And we have a caller on the line, Max in Berkeley. Max, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you for an excellent program. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I'd like your guests to explain the electoral process. It's based on proportional representation, but I gather that some of the members of parliament are elected directly, and they just had completed the second round, and the Muslim Brotherhood did quite well. But also, in addition, there were three areas of the country where the election process was conducted at separate times, and I gather that in the first area, in the big cities, Alexandria and Cairo, we're talking about fairly liberal areas, and some people are terribly nervous as to what's going to happen in the rural areas. And last, I'll say that something comes to my mind. I'm thinking of the elections that took place in Algeria, that were won overwhelmingly, it would appear, by the Salafist movement. And, of course, this led to a showdown between the army and that movement, with disastrous consequences for Algeria. More than 100,000 people died. But anyway, thank you for a good program. I'd like your guests to address these questions that I have raised. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Max. Juan Cole, do you want to start?
Right. Well, I think I cautioned against trying to game out the results of these elections, and I'm not sure. I mean, it's entirely possible that the rural areas will vote for the Muslim religious parties, but I don't think you can assume that. That is to say, there are many rural areas in Upper Egypt where you have a significant Coptic Christian minority. Some of the religious forces are actually well known to be much better organized in city quarters like Mbaba in Cairo than they are in many of the villages. And in Luxor, which is in Upper Egypt, and although it's a tourist center, the places around Luxor are rural. The Egyptian bloc, which is an alliance of leftist and a Coptic party, got 40% of the party-based vote. So I think I would just caution against jumping to conclusions about how the rest of the election is going to go and about the relative strength of various parties in the rural and urban areas, because Egypt's elections have been stage-managed. We really don't have a good sense of the political geography of the country.
Well, what about Max's question about the Algerian example from the 1980s? Is that kind of... That kind of conflict, could you imagine that happening in Egypt?
Very easily. As Mona said, we've already gotten a little bit of a taste of that kind of issue with the recent demonstrations and the deaths of 40 demonstrators who were reacting to a memo issued by the vice premier on behalf of the military, and which laid out these prerogatives, including putting the military budget off limits to the parliamentarians, which was absolutely unacceptable to most Egyptians. So there's going to be a lot of conflict over the role of the military going forward. The military hasn't stepped back one inch, as far as I can tell, and in fact, responded to those protests by putting in a prime minister from the Mubarak days, which was a slap in the face of all of the protesters and of the families of the martyrs. So. Could Egypt go in the Algerian direction with very substantial civil conflict over these issues? Certainly. Will the Egyptian military be so stupid as to risk that kind of eventuality? I really wonder, because after all, we have seen what happened in Algeria. They have seen it. And Egypt, unlike Algeria, is a country that is heavily dependent upon its relationship with the rest of the world. Tourism is a huge industry. Suez Canal tolls, strategic rent from the United States, that is to say foreign aid. All of these inputs come from Egypt being a relatively calm, orderly place that's welcoming of the outside world. And it would be, collective suicide for the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to throw the country into a long-term civil war over its prerogatives.
Mona?
The election process that the caller mentioned, one interesting feature of it, of course, is that it's very protracted. That is, the elections are going into three phases to cover three different parts of the country. The reason there's that very strange process is because, and this is due to the history of elections under Mubarak, which for the most part were stage managed, but also included struggles by civil society organizations to get a semblance of electoral supervision, which ultimately meant that Egyptian judges became the supervisors of the election process. There are about 11,000 judges in the country. They can't all supervise all 60-some thousand polling stations, and so the solution has been to stagger the process across three phases that's going to end on January 5th. The reason that this is important is because, given that the first phase has just been conducted, as the caller indicated, in the major urban centers, and given that we see the lead by both the moderate Islamists and the more extremist Salafis, many people are now watching the next two phases very closely, particularly those secular Egyptians in the remaining areas of the country that haven't yet experienced voting, to see whether they're actually going to go out in droves to try to right the balance somewhat and vote more for the liberal forces, the revolutionary forces, to give them a bit of a leg up in parliament. And so the next two phases are going to be very interesting to see the kind of turnout we're going to see, but also which sorts of candidates and parties are going to get support.
So, I mean, it seems to me that the stakes are really high here, this constitution that might be written, this, you know, real uncertainty about what the role of the military is going to be, what it might do to try to hold on to power, to prevent, to either stage manage things or prevent a real move to a legitimate civilian government. And clearly also it has foreign policy implications. And when looking at the response of the United States last month, after elections in Tunisia, Hillary Clinton was saying the Obama administration would work with the Islamist parties that seem to be emerging in the Muslim world. Then yesterday, following the Egyptian parliamentary elections last week, she sent out a kind of different signal. She said, you know, she was kind of saying, free and fair elections are not enough. There have to be these different kinds of democratic norms that have to be adhered to. And I'm really interested to get a response from both of you about what role you see the United States playing right now and how much ability it has to affect what's happening inside of countries like Egypt and Tunisia. Juan?
The United States has very limited ability to affect the course of developments on the ground in Egypt. Its main point of leverage is actually with the military and with the elite. The United States gives Egypt on the order of $1.5 billion a year in military and civilian aid. That's a little bit of a shell game, I should say, that right out front, that actually the U.S. government gives U.S. corporations $1.5 billion, and then they are to transfer their goods over to Egypt. So the Egyptians benefit from it very indirectly. Of course, the generals benefit in having nice new shiny weapons. But they would be very reluctant to lose that. And military officers in Egypt train in the United States. They do joint exercises with the U.S. military. Egypt is designated as a non-NATO ally of the United States. That gives it special access to certain kinds of sophisticated weaponry. So if the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff calls over to a general, to Field Marshal Tantawi and says, 40 people killed in demonstrations is unacceptable to the United States, you must pull back, then that certainly would have an impact. And it's not that they can order them around. The United States can't order the Egyptian military around, but It can push. It can have a real impact. And I think that there's some reason to believe that one of the reasons that the military stayed neutral last February and allowed Mubarak to go out of office, indeed probably pushed him out, was severe American pressure not to go in the Algerian direction.
Mon al-Ghabashi, what are your thoughts about the role the U.S. can play, what kind of leverage it has? And also be interested, so Juan is talking about the primary leverage that there might be is on the military. But if there were to be a future government that didn't just have the military standing behind it running things, might it not have some interest in having good relations with the U.S. and continuing the aid military otherwise?
I think the U.S., ever since the uprising in Egypt broke out in January, has been scrambling to find a way to deal with this emerging new reality in Egypt, where what we're witnessing now is a very rapid daily shifting of the political landscape every day, with new actors arriving on the scene, not just the Salafi parties, but all of these new youth groups that were really not able to enter the political arena in any way during Mubarak's era. There are also different variations that are emerging within the Islamist camp. One reason why the Salafi Nur party may be getting such unexpected good showing in the elections is there may be splits within the Islamist camp itself. So the U.S. has been scrambling to find a way to find a toehold in this new raucous political arena in Egypt. And, of course, their main toehold is with the military rulers of the country. They've had these relationships with these high-ranking Egyptian military generals for years. Reportedly, during the actual revolution and thereafter, military officials in the Defense Department were constantly on the phone with their Egyptian counterparts. And now what they're trying to do, both in the State Department and also in the Pentagon, is to try to find a way to deal with these emerging political forces. So back in June, the U.S. made this public policy shift and announced their intentions to start talking to some of these moderate Islamist parties, primarily the Muslim Brothers. Whether that the U.S. is going to be able to find coalition partners or junior partners in the emerging Egyptian political scene remains to be seen, because the Egyptian public is still very wary of the role of the U.S., not just for its historic role in propping up Mubarak and his fellow autocrats, but also in the way that the U.S. has very consistently sided with the SCAF in the past few months, despite their rhetorical attempts to appear to be supporting a democratic transition, et cetera.
That's Mona al-Ghabashi. She's a political science at Barnard College, an expert on economics and politics in Egypt. Also with us today on Your Call is Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, creator of the Informed Comment blog, and his latest book is Engaging the Muslim World. And here on Your Call today, we are talking about the future of democracy in the Middle East, looking at the Egyptian elections. We'll also be talking about developments in Tunisia and other parts of the region. When these revolutions were happening in the streets in Tahrir Square and other places, everyone was transfixed by them. And now these in Egypt and Tunisia, they're at a different stage. Obviously, there are continuing demonstrations pushing for democratic reform, but there are also elections. I want to know if you've been following these elections, what they mean to you, what you want to understand about them, and what you think, as citizens of the United States, the role of our government ought to be. Hillary Clinton came out yesterday and said free and fair elections may not be enough. She's saying there have to be democratic norms among those who win elections. I want to know what you think here on Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. The number to call, 866-798-8255. Why do you think these Islamist parties are so popular? What do you want to know about them? And how should the U.S. respond? 866-798-8255 or 866-798-TALK. We'll be back after this break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. You can friend KALW on Facebook. It's another way to spread the word about the programming you value on local public radio. It's as easy as clicking the link to KALW's Facebook page on our website, kalw.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We are now podcasting our show. You can find more information at our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to archive shows there and sign up for our email newsletter to keep up with what's coming up. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the challenges facing young gays, lesbians, and transsexuals with educator and activist Ron Schmidt. And on Friday, Rose is going to be back in town for our weekly media roundtable. If you have a show idea for us, you can always send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We are talking about the emerging new reality in the Middle East, places like Egypt and Tunisia, where instead of going to the street, people are now going to the polls. We want to know, does it matter to you? Do you think that not just the U.S. government, which clearly has a stake in what happens in the region, but American people, do you feel like you have a stake in whether or not there's real democracy in places like Egypt and Tunisia? What do you want to know about what's happening? We have a couple of great experts on the line with so much insight and knowledge. We'd like to have you join the conversation. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you want to understand about the elections that are going on, the parties that seem to be in the lead, from Muslim religious parties of different stripes, not all the same? That's part of what we're breaking down today. Your calls and questions at 866-798-8255, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. With us are Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, creator of the Informed Comment blog, and author of the book Engaging the Muslim World. Also with us is Mona Agobashi. She's a political scientist at Barnard College and an expert on economics and politics in Egypt. Let's go to the lines and speak with Antonio in San Leandro. Antonio, welcome to Your Call.
Good morning. The first thing you have to look at is when you see Hillary Clinton and John McCain going to Cairo to celebrate the so-called revolution, you have to question what happened there. And I think in the whole north of Africa, what happened, there were some revolts in Tunisia and in Egypt that actually didn't have an alternative political program. They were embracing the military. So when you are embracing the military, you can understand from the beginning where it goes. Then you have the same situation around the world, because you have all these taking over the plazas in the United States and Spain and Greece. And there's no political program, no alternative political program. And that's the main thing. So I say there was no revolution in north of Africa. Actually, in Libya, actually, was a counter-revolution. And it's something what Machiavelli said. Just change a bit in order to continue with the same. That's the capitalist plan. That's the imperialist design.
Antonio, I want to get a guest response to that. Mona Agobashi, what do you think? Was there really a lack of an alternative program in these revolutions? Is this, you know, in some ways just moving the deck chairs instead of changing the system?
Well, Antonio is partly right. I mean, these were popular uprisings. They weren't and they aren't full-fledged revolutions because the revolutionary forces haven't yet taken control of the state nor the government. But I would disagree sharply with the idea that these are merely a reshuffling of the deck chairs. That might indeed be the outcome, but we're still less than a year away from the first anniversary of these revolutions, and when we look at the way that things develop, it's not going to take 12 months. It's not even going to take 24 months. These are, I think, major ruptures in the regimes that we've seen being put in place for about 30 years, and what we're seeing right now is a fluid reality that might indeed end up looking like a revamped authoritarianism or an upgraded dictatorship. But I just think it's a little way, way too early to make that judgment call.
Juan Cole?
Well, Antonio's intellectual framework is really stuck in the Cold War, when the question was, do you have a capitalist system or do you have a socialist system? And if you have a capitalist system, then that is supported by the United States and Western Europe. And if you have a socialist system, then that's supported by Russia and China. Well, that's not the way the world is anymore. And first of all, none of these systems was socialist in the Marxist sense, and Ben Ali's system was kind of a nepotistic kleptocracy. Something similar could be said of Egypt and of Libya. These were deteriorating developmental states where the states used to take care of people and increasingly were taking care of themselves and their cronies. And the popular uprisings were in part an uprising against a corrupt state elite, which was stealing from people. I mean, the Gaddafis had stashed, some people say as much as $200 billion out of the country. The Mubarak is accused of having stashed $70 billion outside. I mean, these are poor countries, so to take that kind of money out is incredible. And the West was supporting all three, heavily supporting all three. So to any extent that they were socialist, quote-unquote, governments, their main patrons were the United States, France, and Britain. And none of those countries wanted to see these changes happen. The French defense minister actually offered to train Tunisian police in how better to repress the protesters last year this time. It was only when it seemed clear that the governments, or at least the leaders, could not survive, when people were out as masses in the street in an unexpected way, and in some ways in an unprecedented way, that the Western governments reluctantly signed on and were pulled, dragging and kicking into a new order. And the Chinese and the Russians didn't behave any better. And so I just think that while I agree that you want to measure the outcome of these changes, not only by what kind of political changes occur, but what kind of political economy emerges, that the framework of imperialism plus socialism just does not apply to these three. And one thing that can be said is that to the extent that the Ben Ali and Trabelsi clans in Tunisia, the Mubaraks and their cronies in Egypt, the Gaddafis in Libya had expropriated so much of the wealth of the country and channeled it to a narrow 1% or less elite, that stranglehold has been broken, and so the economic system, at the very least, is opened up ipso facto to some extent by these uprisings.
I want to go to Ruby in Mill Valley, who is called in on 866-798-825. That's the number if you'd like to join our conversation about the future of democracy in the Middle East and what the U.S. role might or might not be. Ruby, good to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you so much. And your guest's last comments are very telling, and it's more or less why I called in. In our knowledge, we know that all of these countries are countries of tribes, and there are so many disparate forces and objectives between these tribes. And the repressive leaders that we have been supporting have kept control of all of that. And I'm guessing that's why we supported the Mubaraks, etc. And your guest just alluded to the fact that not much is going to change or can change at this moment as far as economic opportunities, etc. My question is, what do we expect them to have democratically? What kind of democracy do we expect them to have? Surely it's not going to be like ours. Or is it? Is that what we're thinking?
Mona Elgobashi, you want to give a response to Ruby? And just to what Secretary of State Clinton said yesterday, she said democratic norms and defined them as respect for universal human rights, including women's rights, free religious practice, the promotion of tolerance and good relations among communities of different faiths, and support for peaceful relations with neighbors. Not saying that I'm endorsing that definition, just to give one of them that's been put out there. But yeah. What do you think, Mona?
Well, what kind of democracies are we seeing emerge? First, we don't know that democracies will emerge. That's one thing. But the second and most important thing is, instead of asking, well, what kinds of democracies are going to emerge, or are they going to look like the U.S. democracy? Instead, I prefer to look at it as, here is this process where ordinary people are trying, as they have been trying for the past 30 years. The only difference is that with these uprisings, they're doing so in a very spectacular fashion and with extraordinary collective action that, as Juan pointed out, may indeed be unprecedented, at least in the second half of the 20th century. They're trying to exert some sort of popular control over the decisions that affect their lives. That means not just political decisions, but also economic decisions, key questions about the redistribution of national wealth and national resources, breaking apart these very destructive chains of crony capitalism that hoarded national resources to very, very narrow groups and clans, the two major clans, of course, being the Mubarak clan and the Ben Ali Trabulsi clan. If we're going to talk about tribes, then you can think of these indeed as very extended tribes. Also, crucially, what these popular forces are trying to do is to exert some sort of democratic popular control over foreign policies. Because foreign policies are not just about whether these countries are going to go to war with Israel. It's about the kinds of economic linkages that the United States and its former client regimes built with the Israeli economy. So to give you one example, the sale of Egyptian natural gas to Israel, which supplies Israel with 40% of its natural gas needs, was done completely undemocratically by executive order, and Egyptian citizens for the past 5 years have been trying to, through the courts and through protests and demonstrations and other means, have been trying to exert some sort of accountability for how their natural gas and other resources are being used in the regional political economy. So I don't know what kinds of democracies are going to emerge. What I'm watching is to see the kinds of ways in which popular forces are going to try to exert some sort of accountability over those who hold power, mainly the military, its foreign backers, and domestic political forces that may ally with the military.
Mona Al-Ghubaishi, that is some great... I don't think many people talk about the economic ties between Egypt and Israel. It's really important context to have as these changes happen. But I do want to kind of return to part of what Ruby's question was, following what you're talking about, these popular uprisings and how they're going to translate into a different kind of perhaps democratic, perhaps not, government in Egypt. Those uprisings had strong representation of secular forces, liberal forces, and I think people look at the results of last week's parliamentary elections and say, where were they? What would you say? Why weren't they more successful?
The secular and liberal forces indeed tried as much as they could to enter the political game, but of course protests are one way of doing politics and elections are another way of doing politics, and the organized Islamist forces have a long history of electioneering. They actually know how to conduct campaigns. They know how to press the flesh. They know how to interface with voters. And the secular forces, partly as a result of repression and partly as a result of their own internal bickering, don't know how to outreach to people very well. And so many people were watching to see how they would start doing that in the elections. They did a decent job, not as good a job as the Islamists because they simply don't have the organization. But we still, again, have about a month left of electioneering, and it would be interesting to see whether they might adjust their behavior or at least accelerate their campaigning in the next month to try to get a few more deputies in.
Ooh, that is Mona Al-Ghubaishi. She's assistant professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. She's an expert on Egypt's politics and economy. Also with us today on Your Call is Juan Cole, who does the Informed Comment blog. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. And we are asking you what the emerging democracies look like to you in the Middle East. What kind of stake do you feel in them when you follow and hear, okay, here's what these elections are like. What do you want to know? What do you want to understand about who has power and how things are changing or not changing? The number to call is 866-798-8255. Do you feel like you have a stake in there being real democracy in the Middle East, and what might that look like? 866-798-8255, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Ahmed in San Francisco. Ahmed has some ideas about the U.S. role. Ahmed, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. It just seems to me that the U.S. gave its tacit approval to the Islamists by allowing the Arab Gulf states to get involved in the election, throw their weight behind the Islamists, like Qatar, send $100 million, Saudi Arabia, send billions of dollars in 9 months. And the Islamists will not follow through on the democracy thing. It's already the head of the Brotherhood said that his position is higher than the position of a president of the country, should it ever be elected. And the army saying that even if the Islamists, whoever we're going to make win in the election, will not form the government because they're forming a government right now. So, I mean, it seems like most Egyptians like kind of between a rock and a hard place, between the dictatorship of the military and the Islamists who know nothing about running a government, and it just I don't see where the Islamists will take the country, since they just have no clear idea. I mean, they all talk about God and about, you know, how women should get dressed. I mean, if they veil everybody, so what? I mean, the problem of Egypt is hunger, it's food, it's education, it's economy. It's not that women are not veiled enough. I mean, who cares?
Ahmed, I'd like to just hear from you before we get a response from our guests. What role would you, thinking about the United States, and I mean, you're talking about the role that it is playing, what would you like to hear Hillary Clinton say? Or what are those backroom conversations you wish would go on between the U.S. and a government in a place like Egypt?
I think Hillary Clinton is like just, I mean, she started from like a couple of months ago, we'll deal with the Islamists and we'll deal with the government. And it's just, it sounded like she's helping the Islamists, that we'll deal with them, and there is a lot of moderate Islamists and all this nice talk, which is fine and dandy. But at the same time, she let Saudi Arabia throw $3 billion behind the Islamists. There's 166,000 people went to pilgrimage. It's said that Saudi Arabia paid for half of them by sending money to the Brotherhood. They just bought a building for $100 million. And all over the country, they're building buildings and throwing money, giving sugar and meat and food to the poor.
All right, Ahmed,
I mean, it's... Yeah. And the United States did not say one word, Saudi Arabia or Qatar. United States, I mean, these Gulf states would not take a piss without United States telling them to take a piss.
Ahmed, thanks for the call. Let's get a response from Juan Cole.
Well, certainly all of us suspect that Gulf money is coming into Egypt and affecting the outcome of these elections and supporting the activities of some of these Muslim fundamentalist groups. I don't believe it's the case that the United States really has anything to say about that. That is to say, I don't believe that were the United States to call up Saudi Arabia and say, don't do that, that the Saudis would stop doing it. I think the caller has an unrealistic impression of the power of the United States. In fact, the Saudis have been angry at the U.S. They didn't want Mubarak to go in the first place. And they also felt that the U.S. didn't support them on the Bahrain issue. So the Saudis are not in a mood to listen to orders from Washington. I think the thing to remember about the sort of Muslim fundamentalist parties, both in Egypt and in Tunisia, is that they made their way in the world by standing up for little people. The governments back in the 60s and 70s had been kind of post-colonial developmentalist states, had announced that, you know, the welfare of the public was their main goal, had expanded education, healthcare, and so forth. But from the 90s forward especially, they became much more neoliberal states, neoliberal in the sense of letting the market have a bigger role, not worrying so much about social inequality. And a lot of people got left behind. And in Egypt, the Muslim fundamentalist groups organized to do soup kitchens and free clinics and so forth. And so they established an image in the mind of the public that they cared about people in a way that often the government seemed not to, and the government, you know, had its hand in the till. So it should be remembered that some of the success that they're now having in these elections has to do with a longstanding perceived commitment on their part to public welfare, to uprightness. Also, they have campaigned against corruption. They're widely thought not to be corrupt themselves in a system where you know, bribery is necessary to get the smallest thing done. So what I would say is that it's not fair to say that they've only done well because of foreign money. There may be some foreign money. And it's also not fair to say that the United States wanted them to win. That's ridiculous. The United States has been very upset about its allies being overthrown, and by the rise especially of Muslim fundamentalist parties, because U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East only has a few pillars. It wants stability. It wants the oil to come out of the Persian Gulf without any problems. It wants the neighbors of Israel to make nice with Israel not have bad relations with it, and so on and so forth. And that's what Hillary Clinton said about defining democracy. It's all code for those U.S. interests. It has nothing to do with democracy, in my view. And what she was trying to do was to warn the Muslim Brotherhood Party in Egypt that it's not to break the...
don't go too far.
Israel. Yeah, don't go too far. But also, you know, there are domestic constituents in the United States would be very upset if the Muslim Brotherhood put in personal status laws that disadvantaged the Coptic Christians, who are probably on the order of 10% of the population. So all of the definitions that Hillary gave of democracy were, you know, U.S., domestic, and foreign interests should be preserved in the course of these changes. And I think it's very unrealistic on her part to expect this to be the case.
That's Juan Cole. Also with us is Mona Ogobashi. We're talking about democracy in the Middle East, whether it's emerging, how it's emerging in countries like Egypt and Tunisia. If you'd like to get on the conversation, we have about 5 minutes left. The number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to read an email that we got from a listener, I think is following up on what Antonio had to say, saying, what is your guest opinions of whether the Libyan uprising was a true popular rebellion, or whether, as some American leftists believe, a Western imperialist-inspired coup? And why did Western Europe, followed by the U.S., turn against Gaddafi so relatively quickly, since the West and Gaddafi had all, in some cases, literally kissed and made up? Quick responses from both of you. Mona, you want to start?
Well, the Libyan uprising began on February 17th. That was 5 days or 6 days after Mubarak had been toppled and after, of course, the Tunisian dictator had left. And so the United States, I think, at that moment read that there this regional wave of uprisings was not going to abate very soon, and they decided that it was easier and probably better for them to, of course this took time, but to eject Gaddafi, who had, of course, been in power for 40 years, and to try to game that process very quickly so that Libya also doesn't get lost the way Egypt and Tunisia were perceived to have been lost by the West in the initial stages.
One call?
Oh, it was a popular uprising. The Gaddafi regime was horrible and oppressed people, and especially the east of the country had been disadvantaged by his policies economically and politically. The United States was not interested in intervening in Libya. The Obama administration was dragged into that by the Western Europeans. And the Western Europeans each had their own reasons for wanting to do this. As the person who wrote the email said, Gaddafi had been reintegrated into the international order. The Western oil companies had done their bids. Everybody, I think, in the West would have been perfectly happy for him to stay there, but not at the cost of an Algeria-style civil war, which might drive the population into the arms of al-Qaeda, might cause massive immigration into Europe, cause instability in the Mediterranean region, and I think both Sarkozy and David Cameron of the UK decided that an intervention was necessary to preserve regional order, and they dragged the U.S. into it.
Well, we're in the closing minutes of our program, and I kind of want to ask both of you. I mean, one of the great things about this year, of these uprisings, of the changes that have followed, in spite of all the contradictions in them and the stops and starts, has been that this change in the conversation about how we talk about the Middle East, it's not just these certain leaders dealing with major powers in Europe, elsewhere, but there actually is a role for the people in the street to change the conversation and to, I mean, overthrow governments. And I guess, you know, when we talk about Hillary Clinton, what's the message she's sending to the Muslim Brotherhood or to certain leaders in these countries, what do you think, though, the role, the U.S., the way it responds, how that affects what does happen at the popular level? Does the U.S. have an impact on what happens to those popular movements and how emboldened they are? Mona?
Well, I think that the popular movements, and as you pointed out, I just want to underline what you said about how we're in for a period of what some people may perceive to be extreme instability. But instead, what we should be seeing this as is the rise to power or the entering of the public space of interest groups and points of view that have been repressed for years and years. So there's something fundamentally positive and fundamentally just about finally these people who have been repressed for so long finally getting a say in or attempting to get a say in how their countries are being governed and the directions that their political economies are taking. Now, how do they respond to the United States policy overtures and statements and so on? Generally, still very skeptical. Again, given the U.S. role both before the uprisings and during the uprisings, the halting way in which the U.S. has tried to contain the full effect of these popular uprisings has made most of public opinion in these countries very wary of U.S. politicians' pronouncements on democracy, et cetera, especially Secretary Clinton's latest remarks. I fully agree. These are code words for keep the status quo and keep the structure of foreign interests as much as possible the same. Don't go too far. And I don't think that that's going to be welcomed very heartily by much of public opinion in the Arab world.
Juan Cole, 30 seconds. Your thoughts?
Well, the U.S. has done a very poor job of public diplomacy throughout this period and hasn't gotten credit, therefore, for some of the good things it did do. Leon Panetta went to Cairo a couple months ago and tried to convince the military government to lift the state of emergency before the elections. He warned that it would taint the elections if they were held under state of siege laws. I never saw much reporting about this, and none of the Egyptians I talked to even know that it happened. So I think the U.S. Has been so cautious in not wanting to upset the apple cart that it hasn't gotten credit for some of the adjustments Washington has made to the new situation, and I think there's a danger there.
Juan Cole, thank you so much. This is Your Call. We've been talking to Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, and his latest book is Engaging the Muslim World. You can also read his writing on the Informed Comment blog. Also with us this hour, Mona Al-Ghobashi, political scientist at Barnard College. Thanks to both of you for being with us on Your Call.
Thank you.
Great
thank
to
you.
Have you. Good conversation. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. I'll be right back to tell you what's coming up tomorrow. How much better have things gotten for LGBT youth? On the next Your Call, we'll talk to Ron Schmidt, author of Once Removed, about his journey from life as a closeted gay student in Catholic schools through alcoholism and psychotherapy to working as a teacher in California's public schools where he started organizations to support LGBT youth. Are schools safer for queer students and families today? What's the best way to help LGBT youth feel safe and supported? It's Your Call with guest host Angie Coiro and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.